Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And joining us in the studio today is a roving cartoonist who is credited with originating the War Reportage comic. He's a Guggenheim fellow who makes his home in Portland when he's not out dodging tracer bullets. His books include Notes from a Defeatist, Palestine, Safe Area Gorazda, and the newly released Footnotes in Gaza. Joe Sacco, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, your current book is a heavy sucker in more ways than one. In keeping with the epic graphic stories of the past decade, this one weighs in at 400 pages. And the focus of the book is unusual as well. Not necessarily what readers would expect. Could you explain to our listeners about the book and the title, Footnotes in Gaza?
Okay, well, the book is basically about two incidents that took place in 1956. I read about them in a UN document. This took place during the Suez Crisis, when the Israeli army conquered the Gaza Strip, kicked out the Egyptians who were administering Gaza. And according to this UN document, there were a lot of casualties in two towns. One was Han Yunus, where about 275 Palestinians were killed. And the other
and
was...
And these were civilians.
It seems almost entirely to be, or unarmed men in civilian clothing, because some... You know, some might have been soldiers who had put on civilian clothing. And then there was another incident in Rafah in a few days later, and 111 Palestinians died there. And according to the UN report, the Israelis said that the Palestinians were resisting in both cases. The Palestinians denied that. And I figured, well, these are two very large-scale events. Perhaps there are still some people left alive who can tell the story. Survivors. So why not go there and find some and talk to them and see if that can be done. And of course, there's another component to the story, and that is I always like to show the process of getting the story. So some of it takes place in real time, in the present day, and that was in 2002, 2003. So there's a lot about the people I met along the way, the process of getting the story, the home demolitions that were going on in both Han Yunus and Rafah, more contemporary stories in there as well.
Right. We switch back and forth. And early in the book, we find you, your character, deciding that you're going to head into Gaza without press credentials. So essentially you wing it, and fortunately the gamble pays off. But it's interesting when we find out in the book the reason why you were originally denied press credentials.
Yes, the Israeli foreign press credentials officer told me that, you know, this is not real-time news. And the rules sort of change. They can change from week to week. But in this case, they decided that they would only give press credentials to people who were basically on regular newspapers or regular magazines. And this was something – I was trying to get press credentials because I thought it would be just easier to facilitate what I was doing. But, well, they said no. But yeah, like you say, I winged it. I mean, he basically said, take a chance at the border. And at that time, it was still possible to get in without much fuss, depending on what the soldiers at the border decided. A few months later, things changed pretty considerably. And now, of course, it's all but impossible to get in unless you're very credentialed and you really have something definite.
Right. The political landscape has changed quite a bit in the 7 years since you started researching the book. The U.S. at the time had not yet invaded Iraq, and also the political status of Gaza was different from the present situation.
Yeah, I mean, when I was there, the Palestine Authority was in charge in Gaza, but there were also Jewish settlements and Israeli army forces in Gaza itself based there. Since I left, the Jewish settlements were withdrawn unilaterally by Prime Minister Sharon, and... Hamas took over. Hamas basically has Gaza now and is in charge. So a lot did change.
Right. About Hamas, there's no shortage of infighting in Gaza. And back when you were researching the book, Fatah party officials, that's the party of Arafat, were throwing their weight around, and Hamas partisans kind of got the short end of the stick. Now it's Hamas that's in power in Gaza, and Fatah loyalists are getting harassed and purged.
No, that's very true. I mean, what I'm hearing from my friends is that Hamas has a very tight control, and whether it's coming from orders from above or if it's just activists on the street, they're giving they're giving Fatah people a pretty bad time. And a lot of my friends in Gaza aren't particularly pleased with Hamas rule. It's tough. And I mean, Hamas is...
The Israelis certainly aren't.
Yeah, of course not. Of course not. I basically feel sorry for the people of Gaza because they're blockaded from without, and from within they have Hamas rule. And I mean, both of those things, one of them is enough. To have to be both under Hamas rule and blockaded is a little much, I think.
Yeah, reading any one of the chapters in your book, it's hard to imagine how anyone living in the refugee camps can keep their sanity. The level of post-traumatic stress has got to be off the charts. Even after a week, as you portray in the book, what with all the drones and the shellings and demolitions, you're bleary from lack of sleep. If you extrapolate that to a childhood or even an adulthood, that's got to be unlivable.
You're right. I mean, you put together the level of violence with the level of poverty, and it's pretty miserable-making, I mean, to say the least. And yeah, children are growing up around that sort of thing. They see it every day. What is interesting, though, is despite all that and despite the trauma, and people are traumatized, they try to let life go on. I mean, they try to make life go on. So sometimes, even when homes were being demolished on the border there at Rafah between Gaza and Egypt, even when homes were being demolished, a few hundred meters away, on the main road of Rafah, life is going on. The markets are open. Kids are going to school. If it was quiet, you could hear the bulldozers. But it's the noise of the street that sort of drowns out the bulldozers.
Yeah, you were mentioning how loud the street can get just first thing in the morning.
Yeah, it was always waking me up. I've always suffered from lack of sleep. So I never sleep particularly well when I'm traveling doing this sort of thing. And Gaza is loud.
Let's talk about your adventures in Gaza. One of your constant companions was a local fellow named Abed Alassouli, who gets you all sorts of access. And Abed is something of a contradiction. On the one hand, he has contempt for some of his educated friends who have taken on cushy government jobs for the steady paycheck. He's got a strong sense of solidarity. On the other hand, he's looking for any opportunity to get out of Gaza, you know, go abroad, get a business degree.
Yeah, I think what he was looking for was to go abroad so he could come back and help his community. And that's, in fact, what eventually he ended up going abroad a couple of times and studying. And now he's back there and trying to do something with what he's learned overseas. His idea was always, I would like to see something of the West. I need to understand the West, but I don't want to get sort of seduced by the West. He understood the seductive aspects of the West, definitely.
And speaking of the West, there are various scenes in the book where you get together socially with diplomats and fellow journalists from around the world, including some that you've met during the Balkan War in the 1990s.
There's a few people. I mean, the funny thing is about journalists who cover this sort of stuff is you can run into them in different places, and sometimes it's amusing. I remember once being in Sarajevo, and some guy came into the hotel where I was at and just looked around the room and said, has anyone seen Jean-Luc here? And I remember saying, I don't know who that is. And he just said, he saved my life in Afghanistan. I mean, all this kind of like really overly dramatic sort of connections between.
So sometimes life imitates Hollywood.
Sometimes it does. Actually, sometimes it really does. But I've got to say, I mean, it's important to have those friends. Those are the people you bounce ideas off of. Those are the people you grumble to about your editors and what's being done to your stories. And those are the people who actually they really can talk a refined game. And sometimes it doesn't really get into their articles. But a lot of them really care about what's going on there. And I'm talking about even, you know, mainstream journalists.
Right. Well, print journalists, certainly. You were a journalism student once yourself. But I get the impression you have no love lost for the cable news networks. You portray their coverage of the lead up to the Iraq War none too kindly.
The first time I ever saw the Fox News Network was in Jerusalem in 2002. I was staying at a friend's place waiting to get into Gaza. And it was on one of the cable channels. And I thought it was a parody show. That's the truth. I mean, it was leading up to the war. But the level, I mean, these people were anchors and their small talk amongst themselves, I thought it was, they had to be, I mean, I really did think this was some sort of a joke show.
like the Daily Show or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why the Daily Show sort of works. It sort of puts its finger on something real about that kind of thing. So yeah, I have no love lost for the cable, a lot of the cable networks, and I think they were sort of eating it up, the impending war.
There's a lot of smoking that goes out in these war zones, at least in your depictions of the war zones. I got to wondering whether smoking goes along with a constant sense of fatalism, or whether a nicotine buzz is just what's called for in an endlessly stressful environment. Or am I reading too much into the whole thing?
You might be reading too much into the whole thing. I mean, obviously, people might smoke more out of a sense of nervousness and to calm themselves. But, I mean, I can name European countries like Germany where a lot of people smoke. And there are places that smoke a lot. The Arab world is a very smoking world. I've had people offer me cigarettes and tell me with a straight face, it's good for my health if I have this cigarette. It'd be good for my lungs. So they often don't have a conception of...
Well, they smoke the hubbly bubbly, which is at least
right.
It's not as harsh.
No, that's right. But the Arab world, like I think that even the Chinese are also heavy smokers. There are cultures that aren't like in warfare situations, but they're heavy smokers.
You're obviously comfortable in the role of a correspondent. You graduated from the journalism school at the University of Oregon, and in books such as Palestine, we see you tossing around reporter speak, such as Inverted Triangle. But your early cartoon work tended more towards the burlesque, lots of take-no-prisoners satire about the 80s cultural scene.
Yeah, and I kind of miss that. You know, it's like the problem with doing the sort of thing I do is that it's very difficult to let other parts of your personality come to the fore in your work. I mean, I'm working with very serious stuff, and you have to give... serious material it's due. But to be honest, I would like to get back to humorous work and work that's a bit more creatively challenging than journalism.
Well, for those listeners who are nostalgic for 80s underground music, your previous book that was released is titled But I Like It, and it's a collection of comic stories about your years covering the Northwest punk scene and even touring Europe with one of the bands.
That's right. It was a Portland band called the Miracle Workers. They were kind of a pretty good-sized independent band here in Portland and Los Angeles for a while, and I was a roadie. And that was a very fun experience. In some ways, that was my first reporting gig, in a way, you know.
And it allowed you to end up in Berlin for quite a while.
That's right. I mean, I ended up doing tour posters and things like that when I was there. That's how I made my living for a while, was doing comics and rock stuff.
Well, you're a Portlander, sometimes at least. How much time do you actually spend in Portland, like in country these days?
I'll be honest. I mean, when I was finishing up this book, I spent a lot of time in Portland. I basically told myself I wouldn't really travel for the last couple of years. I mean, I did a quick journey somewhere, but the past year after I finished the book, I started accepting invitations and going around and doing stuff. So I've been back traveling a fair amount. I prefer actually to be in Portland and to be at my drawing table, unless I'm reporting.
Uh-huh. I'm wondering if, you know, it seems like it might be fun to do some of the drawing in other countries, like in European countries that, you know, maybe ones around the Balkans that aren't as expensive as Paris or Prague or London or something.
Yeah, but I sort of need, as I've gotten older, I think I need something more than that. I kind of like a routine. Mm-hmm. I really like the city of Portland. I like the bars I go to. I like the restaurants I go to. I have good friends here. And that stuff sort of helps me unwind. I don't associate those things with my work so much. So mm-hmm. It gives me a chance to, you know, cool off a bit. When you're in another country, I mean, it's fun, but I don't think I concentrate as well. I'm more interested, oh, well, here I am in Europe. I'm kind of thinking I should go out and see this and see that and do this and do that. When you're at home, you're at home. You know, you've got your work room and it feels like you're supposed to be working.
And it seems like you have friends in every country that you go to nowadays.
I have good friends in a lot of places. That's the hard thing about being in one place. But it's kind of nice because you always can meet them when you're traveling around.
Well, there are scenes in the book Footnotes in Gaza where you're just walking down the street, and the sight of your face, your foreign face, as you call it, is the flashpoint for either curiosity or verbal conflict. Now, I'm saying this because you were born on the Mediterranean island nation of Malta, and I'm wondering, What do the Palestinians see when they first look at you? A typical Westerner, a concerned outsider, a potential exploiter?
Well, I mean, this is going to sound odd because this also happened when I was in Bosnia, but they often mistake me for a Japanese person. And, you know, I'm Mediterranean. I don't see any Asian features when I look in a mirror, but other people tend to. So they're always curious. They would say, are you Japanese? I mean, that's it. But, you know, generally speaking, you kind of have to pass the test of, you know, why you here, what's going on, what are you interested in, and then people will help you. There are always going to be people who are suspicious because they feel they see a foreigner and they're often thinking, this is a reporter from outside. What the hell good does it do to speak to another reporter? We're still going to be in the same situation now as we will be in 10 years as we were 10 years ago. Things aren't going to get any better if we tell our stories. Some people feel that, and I understand that. They're embittered. Other people are still will tell their stories.
Oh, yeah, the women especially are passionate. You show all these scenes where you're being ranted at in the book.
Yeah, there are a couple scenes where they see the foreign face and they think, journalist, I'm just going to explode, you know. And sometimes you feel like it's as if they've rehearsed it. It seems like something almost stereotypical that you're going to hear from a woman in a situation like that from that culture. But I think it is genuine, though. It might seem a certain way, but I think it is genuine. They just are allowed to vent their emotions in a way that men aren't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a society where men are supposed to keep it together. And in some interviews, men cried, which is very unusual for a grown man to cry in that culture.
Yeah, they're bringing up tears for the first time in decades.
About things that happened decades ago, that's right.
Right. Right. There's been 50 years that has elapsed. So in some cases, you and Abed are questioning the accounts, wondering about exaggerations or faulty memories. And the survivors that you talk to do have some incredible stories. One of them was cut down in the street in Rafah. Then his face was shot up at close range. And yet, after that, he spends hours playing dead and then survives another 50 years to tell you his story.
Right. And look, there's a good example of someone who I've got no doubt in my head that he was very badly wounded. He was clearly very badly wounded, and other people tell his story. So I think it's a true story. Now, he said that he was hit by 36 bullets. That's where I begin to, you know, you question things. It doesn't mean that he wasn't badly wounded, but people often have a way of putting things that you do have to question, because you know a reader is going to look at that and go, what? And because I'm doing that. I'm sort of saying, come on, is that – okay, maybe it's conceivable, but it seems very unlikely. But the fact that he was shot at close range, that doesn't I don't question that.
You're listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and we're talking with Joe Sacco, comics artist and war correspondent. His latest book is Footnotes in Gaza, a Herculean effort 6.5 years in the making. Now, here's a fact. I hope it's a fact, but here's something that I heard some time ago, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, but I've been told that the Maltese language has some similarities to Arabic. If this is the case, were you able to pick up a working knowledge of Arabic when you were in the Middle East?
I picked up enough Arabic, or I was able to use my Maltese enough so that when I heard things, I get it completely wrong. You know, it's like you hear something, you think you understand, but what you haven't caught is the negative in the sentence. So you think the conversation has gone a certain way and it hasn't. And many times I'm hearing things and I think I'm understanding, but I'm not. I remember once some kids were coming down the street and they were just chanting something. These maybe 5 or 6 kids about 10 years old just chanting something. And he asked one of the people I was with, what are they saying? You know, thinking it was some political slogan. And what they were doing was repeating some detergent commercial, you know, and that really sort of demonstrated to me that, you know, you, things aren't always what they seem.
This is interesting. You left Malta when you were an infant, but you returned at some point in the 80s and produced the first Maltese language comic. It was a romance comic, apparently, with a lot of taboo subjects, at least for such a Catholic culture.
Right. I mean, I'd say it was the first... I wouldn't give myself credit for the first Maltese comics. The first Maltese comic series, I guess, is right. And, yeah, they were romance comics. I had a choice of what I could do, and romance comics just sounded really funny to me. Because I figured, you know, the Maltese don't have a history of comics. They don't have a history of censoring comics or worrying about what it's going to do to young people. So maybe I can really play around with it.
So you got to push the envelope, make it edgy?
Yeah, it was pretty edgy. It was pretty stupid on some level. I mean, they were standard romance comics, except the girl might get pregnant and she might have to go to the Netherlands to have an abortion. But, I mean, in the end, she found true love. You know what I mean? You're using the...
The genre, yeah.
Yeah, the genre, but it's the way you got to the happy ending that seemed a bit odd.
Being a bit of a bricoleur, I like it.
Yeah.
Now, in one of your books, Notes from a Defeatist, you illustrate a story that your mom told you about the bombings of her Maltese village during World War II. Did these stories that you grew up with have any effect on your becoming a self-styled war junkie?
Well, I mean, I think I grew up in Australia, and in Australia there were a lot of European immigrants where we lived. We lived outside of Melbourne, and almost all our friends were European. Almost all the school kids were European. And when their parents would come over, whether they were German, British, Dutch, whatever, the commonality for my parents and the parents of other European kids was the war. They all lived during the war and had immigrated to Australia afterwards. So I heard these stories. These were kind of the table discussions all the time. My parents' stories...
Sounds like good therapy, actually.
I think so. I mean, I think people work them out on a level that's... probably helpful. I'm not sure how well everyone worked them out, but that sort of thing was very familiar to me. And the idea that civilians could be caught up in war, it was something I grew up with. And perhaps maybe that's why I've focused so much on civilians, because often those are the people who get left out of the equation, or when they're reported on, it's because, you know, perhaps a bomb landed on near there and they're hurt, so let's interview them. But I'm always sort of interested in what goes on in a day-to-day level in a situation like that, like how people just survive, even if they're not necessarily, you know, getting shot at all the time. It's things like poverty, what they think about, what still matters to them. That stuff interests me.
You've drawn some very self-critical comics where the world wants to kick you around the block and you don't know whether you're still up to the challenge. Reading your war reportage comics, though, I have to say, and, you know, we're talking Bosnia, we're talking Palestine, during the hottest times and their aftermath, I have to say in all sincerity that I can't bring to mind a single other cartoonist who has the balls to do what you do. And, you know, and never mind cartoonists, it seems like there are precious few reporters these days who are willing to get down in the muck and bring back the story, or maybe there's just no market for it anymore.
I don't know. I mean, well, I'll mention one cartoonist who went to Afghanistan, and that's Ted Rall. And there are some others.
Oh, we've had him on the show actually talking about Silk Road to Ruin.
Yeah, and there are others who's starting to experiment with some of this stuff. To be honest, I don't think I've ever been in a situation that's heavy-duty warfare. I've been with I know a lot of journalists who really have tasted that sort of thing, and I really haven't. But like I say, I'm looking for the white noise of a war situation, not necessarily the explosions themselves. I'm looking for sort of the ordinary voice and give them a hearing.
Well, in the wars of the last 100 years, civilians have been the vast majority of casualties, so they're definitely underreported, especially in Palestine. Part of the reason why these stories don't get out is because of the blockades.
Yes. I mean, you had a situation when Gaza was attacked about a year ago where, as far as I know, there was no mainstream Western reporter in Gaza.
I saw some videos taken by the residents, though, on YouTube, and they were horrifying.
Right. I mean, Al Jazeera actually had a correspondent there, or maybe two correspondents. I don't remember. And some Arab stations might have had some correspondents. But the West, you know, a place like Gaza is hard enough to get to from Jerusalem, that if you're based in Jerusalem, it's about an hour and a half drive. You go in, you come out. So that attack happened when there were no mainstream reporters there. I mean, I guess it's not an important enough situation for Western reporters to be there under these economic considerations that they're going to base a reporter in Gaza.
Yeah, news corporations are constantly cutting back their international operations.
Right. That's right.
Now, I have to say, this is the most impressive thing about the book to me. Under normal circumstances, artists use a lot of reference in their work, archival photographs and illustrations. But in the case of your book, Footnotes in Gaza, an enormous amount of research can go into just a single image. And you weren't able to just open up a National Geographic or go on to Google image search. I mean, you really had to go far afield.
Well, fortunately, to get images of the 50s and what camps looked like, there is a photo archive in Gaza City. The UN has a headquarters there. And I went there, and they actually gave me copies of photographs that they had doubles of. So I got a lot of photographs of what camps looked like over the years, from the late 40s to the 70s or even the 80s. And, of course, I had many from the 50s. So I was able to use that material to give myself an idea of what the places looked like. And, of course, when I'm talking to people, there were specific interviews I did just to ask about what the camp looked like.
Mm-hmm. When you look at a single page in the book, I get the impression that sometimes 10 or 12 pages of photographs, drawings, diagrams might have gone into just this one page or one chapter.
Yeah, well, I mean, cartooning is very labor-intensive. I think any cartoonist can tell you that. It's as someone once said, it's easier to say or write Cadillac than it is to draw one. And it's easier to write tens of thousands of people were in the school than it is to actually draw tens of thousands of people in a schoolyard waiting to be screened, you know.
Yeah, those crowd scenes are astonishing. And you have...
Right. You remind me not to do them anymore.
Crane eye views and everything, right. All these strange angles.
Right.
And your own present day adventures are a big part of Footnotes in Gaza. Mixed in with the accounts of 1956 that you're researching are your investigations, your missteps, your struggles to navigate these absurd situations. And having said that, your character in the book remains something of a cipher. And I think that's in keeping with a long tradition of autobiographical comics. For instance, the reader rarely sees your eyes behind your glasses.
Well, I think the reader never really sees my eyes. I mean, that is some way of signaling to the reader that I'm keeping my distance, that you're going to see some part of me, but generally it's the part of me that will bring the people around me into relief. In earlier comics, I sort of used myself partly for comic relief on some level. But in this one, I think my character comes to the foreground mostly when I'm trying to give people an idea of Palestinian hospitality, how people interacted with me. Because I think people are interested in that sort of thing. I think readers aren't just interested in the situation. They sort of want to know, well, how did people treat you? And I want to show that.
Well, it's interesting to compare Footnotes in Gaza with your earlier work, Palestine. You come across now as a much more sophisticated reporter, comfortable in country, with a Rolodex of colleagues and sources. But also your artwork has dialed down considerably. You stay clear of the wild caricature that was rampant throughout the Palestine book.
Yeah, well, I mean, to address the second question first, you're right. My cartooning is toned down. I never really learned how to draw representationally. I never really learned how to draw.
So I draw rubble like nobody else.
Well, I've seen a lot of it, unfortunately. But when I was drawing the Palestine book, I still came out of that, what cartoonists call the Bigfoot school. I mean, very influenced by Robert Crumb. And
Gilbert Shelton.
I am one of the cartoonists who is very influenced by the American underground comic scene. You know, I'm also influenced by some fine artists like Bruegel the Elder. You know, that's as time's gone by.
Who also influenced Crumb?
Yes, exactly. And you know, I'm influenced by EC Mad Comics, who I think influenced a lot of underground cartoonists.
Right. Your artwork has a very traditional feel to it. Your partial to pen and ink with cross-hatching used for shading. The the classic cartoonists that you remind me of are from a generation or two ago, such as Basil Wolverton or Ron Cobb, you know, both fellow Northwesterners.
Yeah, that's right. I definitely have those influences. But to get to your earlier question, I have toned down a lot of things. I am, okay, if it seems like I'm more sophisticated in the newer comic as I was in the older comic, that's because I probably am more sophisticated. The character I portray in the Palestine book, where I'm bumbling around, that's accurate. I was bumbling around. I often didn't really know what I was doing. I was really trying to do things by trial and error. I mean, I'd studied journalism, but I'd never been in a situation like this. And I was trying to figure it out as I went along. So making mistakes and all that sort of thing, that really did happen. So I'm showing that. Now, of course, over the years, I've done a fair amount of reporting. And you do become more experienced. And you do become you begin to understand things a little better or how to behave in certain situations. So my character reflects that. It's just a matter of portraying myself a bit more honestly. Doesn't mean I still don't make mistakes, but I make less of them.
And I get the impression in the book, especially when you're hobnobbing with other journalists, that you've attained a strong level of respect. This past decade, there's been a lot of ink spilled, so to speak, about the changing face of journalism. You don't blog, you don't tweet, but the kind of reporting you use, the comics form, is not strictly traditional. So with that in mind, how tricky is it for you to get access? And are there some countries, some cultures, who are easier to convince than others that here comes a comics journalist?
Right. I think I was more aware of that and more self-conscious about what I was doing during the first Palestine book, where I felt a little odd telling people what I was trying to do. But at some point, I realized that Palestinians, for example, have a cartoonist in their history called Naji al-Ali. He's very famous. He made a big impression on people. And when I told people I was doing comics, they'd say, oh, like Naji al-Ali. He was an editorial cartoonist assassinated in London. It's never been figured out who. It may have been a Palestinian group that killed him because he criticized everyone, the Israelis, the different Palestinian groups. He was always on the side of the oppressed. But because of him, in some ways, doors opened to me. Recently now, when I was in Gaza doing this book, Footnotes, I took my old book about the Palestinians called, you know, Palestine. I took that with me, and Abed, my guide, would show people the book before I interviewed them. So what I found interesting is rather than being a little embarrassed or I wasn't sure how to put this across, they opened the book. They saw pictures of Gaza. They got it right away. They could see themselves in the book. And I thought later, now, it would be interesting if I brought a prose book along. If they couldn't read English, they would have looked at the book and said, that's nice, but it doesn't really mean anything to me. But when they opened that, they got what I was trying to do, and they saw themselves in those pictures.
And there's something really vital about the comics form when it comes to these stories. I like to think that I'm pretty well informed about the Middle East, at least for an American. But for all the reports that I've heard about refugee camps in the occupied territories, I've never visualized them correctly. You know, I always pictured them as this vast expanse of temporary dwellings, like tents or shacks, like in homeless camps, you know, here in America. But the Rafah camp, as you portray it, has multi-story buildings, boulevards, streetlights. And this, to me, is the power of the comics form, that you have this canvas where you can fill in the gaps left by the print and broadcast media, and your readers can see what you see much more effectively than, say, a video journal.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a time, for example, when the camps looked pretty miserable. When I was there doing the Palestine book, they looked quite different than they do now. But they did build up. You feel like you're in a city. In large areas of the camp. But then there are other parts of the camp.
A city that's constantly like the Blitz in 1940.
Yeah,
in London,
on some level. But, you know, there are parts of the camp that are really old and still pretty decrepit. You're right. I think that's the power of comics, is you can take a reader right to this place and let them see what it looks like. I mean, I find it very important. If I'm thinking of myself as a journalist, you know, I think, what can I do as a cartoonist that's going to be different from someone else? And that is really try to portray what it feels like, the atmosphere of a place. I want to make the street scenes feel noisy somehow. You know, I want the reader to sort of open the page and just be there.
And the small moments in the book are fascinating. The preparation for a holiday feast, the moments of laughter with the families you visit, even the hysterical laughter when you come under tracer fire from the Israeli Defense Force.
Right. And I mean, I was basically laughing because I ran the wrong way and my friends instinctively knew which way to run so they would not be in line of sight of this tower that was, I think it was just firing right over our heads. I don't think it was actually, I don't think it was trying to actually hit us. But I ran the wrong way so that, again, I mean, this is like, I tell that story to show that it actually is very dangerous to walk in these neighborhoods. You don't have to be a militant. In this case, none of us were militants. None of us were armed. We were just walking. And we were opened up on. So that's a way of sort of showing that you could be an ordinary person and get fired at here. And I think that's part of it. The other thing I want to show is this touching moment when one of my friends, Ashraf, says, you know, Joe, we like you very much. Please, you've got to start thinking about what you're doing here. I thought that was actually very touching. And I kind of want to share that with the readers.
Right. And this is all in the Rafah refugee camp. There's an early chapter in your book, Footnotes in Gaza, where you're gathering information inside the refugee camps, and your guides try to set you up in an apartment in town, which is outside the camps. Now, despite their best efforts, you insist on living inside the camp. And this is something I did not expect as a reader. You end up staying in a palatial 6-bedroom apartment near the center of the camp.
Well, I didn't expect that either. I mean, it was almost like a compromise. What I really initially envisioned is I would like to live with a family. I would like to spend time and live with a family. But then you realize you're really making their lives difficult. To have a Westerner, they feel like they have to behave in a certain way. It's very difficult in that conservative society to run into women in the household. I stayed in households for some days and never met the mother of the house unless I asked specifically. Food would come in, but I would never meet a woman in the household unless I just sort of said, listen, I want to meet your mom. Can I do that? And then it was okay. And if you wanted to interview the woman, it was okay. But in some ways, it was a compromise. And it ended up, I felt a little odd. It's funny. Yeah, here you are in a refugee camp. What do people expect? The reader sort of expects it's going to be hell. And there I am in one of an amazingly large place where Abed and I just stayed in one room. We had a lot of space in that place. We had like 3 bathrooms or whatever it was. You know, it was kind of ridiculous.
Well, you had people who came and stayed from time to time. And one of the people you portray in the book is a Palestinian militant who you refer to as Khaled. And Khaled is really intriguing. He's a wanted man, constantly on the move, dodging assassination by the Israeli Defense Force. But he hides in plain sight in the camps among the neighbors who all seem to know him. And in fact, Khaled's the guy who makes the phone calls to arrange the cushy apartment that you stay in.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I've learned, if you actually want to do a story like this, I was going to be there for 2 months. And now, how do people in the community know me at all? They don't. So what you have to do is introduce yourself or have yourself introduced to the people who really are, let's say, in charge of the neighborhood on the street level. And he's one of those people. If he sort of said, yes, this guy's here, he's legitimate, he's doing research, leave him alone, I'm going to be left alone. I mean, in fact, every now and then people would just come and check up on me. People were dropping by all the time. And you never know. Maybe they just want to keep you under a bit of surveillance. But mostly I think at that...
Because you never know who you're dealing with.
You never know who you're dealing with. But I mean, I think mostly they just kind of want to find out what I was finding out about 1956, which was the main, you know, thrust of my research.
Right. I get the impression that next time you're in the occupied territories, Khaled might need to keep his distance now that his face has been featured so prominently in your book.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously that's not his real name, and I cleared some things with him before I put them in. I had things cleared with him as far as how much I was going to say about him or how much he was going to be identified in the book.
So, about 1956, Okay, many of our listeners are aware of the major conflicts in Palestine. The Six-Day War in 1967, for example. The Intifadas, the first one in 1988 and the more recent one in 2000. And, well, the point is that until I read your book, I had never heard of Rafah and Khan Yunis. The bigger events of 1956, yes, the Suez War in Egypt, but not these smaller incidents.
Yeah, and I wouldn't actually call them smaller incidents, but you're right. I mean, and that's why the book is called Footnotes, because these are, if the UN figure is correct, they are very large-scale shootings of Palestinians. And you do have to wonder why this isn't something that you find is highlighted in Palestinian history. And my question to myself was, is it possible to find this story out before the people who lived through it die, and then it's sort of lost to oblivion? Then it is just a few words in a UN document, and that's it.
Well, and even some of the Palestinians that you're interviewing ask you, why are you so interested in 1956? Look what's happening right now. Home demolitions, indiscriminate shellings, constant harassment by helicopters and armored vehicles.
Yeah, to that's the thing about Palestinians. I mean, it's not like the British, who can sort of look back on the Battle of Britain and even romanticize it. If the Blitz was going on year after year for 50 years, the Battle of Britain would be a small part of it. You would be living a reality now, as Palestinians are living a reality now, that is really miserable in Gaza. So, of course, it's survival that matters to them. And it was interesting to be sitting there with Palestinian men, older men, talking about 56. And often their kids were around and their grandkids were around. And sometimes the kids had never even heard the story. And they were surprised to hear about all this. This was new to them. But I think a lot of younger people are under such oppression themselves. They live a hard life themselves. So it's hard to concentrate on the past when the present is so bad.
You know, the book is just out, but I'm wondering if you've already gotten some responses, some other people chiming in. This is always what happens when you do a nonfiction work, that people see the book and now they want to contribute when you couldn't find them in the first place.
Well, actually, I'm hoping that, because I think the missing component in the book, something I did try to find out about but was difficult, was a response from Israeli soldiers who were there. And I talked to ex-battalion commanders in Israel. I talked to historians. And it was just very difficult. You know, they would say, oh, maybe this guy knows something. Maybe that guy knows something. And when it comes down to it, a lot of people said nothing like that happened. Or if it happened, maybe someone else might know about it. I kind of hope that the book does generate some interest in Israel so that an Israeli historian can take it from what I've done and work upon it. You know, what I'm telling is not a complete history of these events. There's something else that can be told. I'm doing what I can do. Others might know how to do another part of it better than that.
Well, the book is Footnotes in Gaza, just out from Metropolitan Books. Our guest today has been war correspondent and comics artist Joe Sacco. You've been listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And Joe, is there a website or any other easy way for listeners to get in touch with your work and with what's going on in your reportage?
I guess the website I refer people to is the one on Fantagraphics.com. That's Fantagraphics with an F. And they have authors' bios, and you can click on an author name, and I'm one of their authors. So they might have some biographical information and other things, but I'm not so web-savvy that I can actually tell you where to go to look me up.
Well, Joe, it's been a real pleasure to have you on KBOO. Please, be safe and come back and see us again.
Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed talking to you.
And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on KBOO.fm. We hope you'll stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your community radio station.